with infinite complacency, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I'm your host, Tracy Savage. How about a little music to get us started off tonight?
NASA Johnson Star. Johnson Star. Welcome to NASA's Johnson Space Center. We are coming in hot, so don't burn up as we enter. We do science every day that affects your daily life. Throw them up for manned spaceflight. Science everywhere. As we engineer the marvels that fly through the air and take us way beyond Earth's level, science everywhere. Because we engineer the marvels that fly through the air, flies us through the air. Control the mission out of Johnson. This is ground.
Hey, this is space. Hey.
Tell me, Houston, what's the problem? It's okay.
Hey.
Oh, it's okay.
Hey.
Because the flight controllers all adjusted. NASA Johnson Star. Johnson Star. NASA Johnson Star. Johnson Star. NASA Johnson Star.
Hey, science daily.
NASA Johnson Star.
Hey, it's amazing.
NASA Johnson Star. Orbiting Earth, International Space Station, where we work and live in space with a crew from several nations. Got Japanese and Russians and that European charm. Throw them up like the Canada arm. Kicking on research. 29K cubic feet revolves around the Earth. Science microgravity revolves around the Earth. Columbus jamming destiny. Kicking out research. Kicking out research.
Train the astro. Not to Johnson. To go to space.
Hey.
To go to space.
Hey.
Cause the missions of tomorrow start today.
Hey.
They start today.
Hey.
As we engineer the future day by day.
NASA Johnson Star. Johnson Star. NASA Johnson Star. Johnson Star. NASA Johnson Star.
Hey, science daily.
NASA Johnson Star.
Hey, it's amazing.
Brian Moore, SLS and PCV, we cannot feel the floor. Cause the lack of gravity, the destinations are an asteroid, Mars, or the moon. We are blasting off, start the countdown soon.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Liftoff. Houston, Houston, Houston.
NASA Johnson Star.
Hey, it's amazing.
NASA Johnson Star.
Well, I hope you enjoyed NASA Johnson Style. It's a volunteer outreach video project created by the students of NASA's Johnson Space Center. They they obviously did an educational parody of Gangnam Style, and it was done to inform the public about the amazing work going on at NASA and the Johnson Space Center. If you want to know more about NASA, you can go to www.nasa.gov, of course, and they have their own Space Center student Facebook, and you would go to facebook.com/nasa.jsc.students. And some of the people who inspired NASA to be created in the first place are people who imagined leaving this Earth and exploring the frontiers beyond. Prophets of Science Fiction is a series that was hosted by Ridley Scott, and he posits the science fiction imaginings of the writers of the past now becoming the science realities of today. In the episode we're going to listen to tonight, Arthur C. Clarke, inventor of the satellite, through such masterpieces as A Fall of Moon Dust, Rendezvous with Rama, and 2001 A Space Odyssey, takes a journey to man's beginnings, his future, and ultimately travels full circle, asking the question, are we alone? I hope you enjoy this little introspective look about Arthur C. Clarke and his contributions to what we do today in science reality.
Who are we? Why are we here? What is our place in the universe?
I think Clarke's books are almost instruction manuals for human evolution in a sense.
An elevator to the stars, colonization of the cosmos. Alien contact.
There is something out there that is as far advanced compared to us as we are compared to ants or plants.
Sci-fi visionary Arthur C. Clarke foresees the evolution of science and helps create it.
Everything about geosynchronous communication satellites goes back to Clarke.
Clarke dares us to imagine, what is the future of humanity?
Tomorrow begins with a spark of imagination. A flash of insight that demolishes yesterday's limitations and inspires technologies to create new worlds. I'm Ridley Scott, and these are the prophets of science fiction.
I think Arthur Clarke was kind of purist in his thinking, and it was evolved. He forced us to think about evolution. How do we get here? Who made us? And then what is the reason for our being? I think it wasn't altogether of this world.
London, Great Britain, 1941. 8 devastating months of Nazi bombing raids leaves over 1 million homes destroyed or damaged. 20,000 are dead. 24-year-old aspiring writer Arthur C. Clarke escapes to the hills outside the city. Stretched out before him in the midday sun lies a vast fleet. Barrage balloons are poised to ensnare low-flying enemy planes in their metal cables. But Clarke looks beyond the hovering weapons and the chaos of war into an exciting vision of mankind's destiny.
It did indeed seem that a fleet of alien spaceships was poised above the city. For a long moment, we dreamed of the distant future.
From his earliest days, Clarke would use his imagination to transport himself far beyond the English farm of his childhood.
He was a very shy boy. When he was growing up in Great Britain, he developed this fantastic ability in his head to develop concepts and to stretch those concepts into the arenas that very few of us have ever explored.
In his late teens, Clarke joins the fledgling British Interplanetary Society, an organization of space enthusiasts who share a common goal, leading mankind into the stars.
The British Interplanetary Society did a lot of wonderful work. It really was a fringe organization in the beginning. lunatics, they called them in the press back then, because these young fellows were talking about going to the moon in the 1930s, and they really thought they were rather crazy.
Clark and his colleagues planned missions to the moon, meticulously calculating the viability of rocket-based spaceflight.
Arthur C. Clarke is a different kind of science fiction writer. And he's bringing a different order of understanding mathematics, theories of physics into the work. This is a guy who looked to the stars and then put his pen to paper, which is a little bit different than just looking into your own head and putting pen to paper.
When you read his books, they are just brimming with ideas, thoughts about things that are, maybe you've never had before, and his purpose in doing that is to get you to think.
Through science fiction, Clark posits stirring questions about the future. His thought-provoking theories first capture the world's attention with Childhood's End. The book tells the story of mankind's first encounter with an advanced extraterrestrial race.
All of a sudden, gigantic spaceships hover over the cities of the world, and they're clearly of alien origin, and human beings have to figure out how to interact with them.
It was the first spiritual science fiction book that I had ever read, a book that talked about the future evolution of humanity. Clark believed that human beings were in a constant state of evolution. I don't think he would have bothered to write his books if he didn't see that potential. They were almost instruction manuals for human evolution, in a sense.
The aliens, nicknamed the Overlords, wield technology so advanced that it seems nearly magical to the people of Earth.
They actually stay hanging above the Earth without actually making contact for a full generation, so that a generation of humans can evolve that sees this alien presence as a fact of life. And then finally, the overlords make contact when their appearance turns out to be something completely surprising and unexpected.
The aliens look demonic, with horns, tails, and leathery wings. The humans speculate endlessly about the overlords' alien biology and what it might indicate about their extraterrestrial world. We continue to speculate about life forms on other planets today. Dr. Lynn Rothschild is an astrobiologist working for NASA. She studies planetary conditions to determine what makes life possible and how life evolves on Earth and beyond.
One of the big things that would affect what life looks like on another planet, particularly if you're starting to look at large life, macroscopic life like us, is what the gravity's like. Now on Earth, we've all evolved under 1G, one gravity. But if we evolved on a planet with 2G or 5G, for example, we would have to have correspondingly thicker legs, would have to have much stronger limbs to hold up our weight, and maybe at some point we'd be pushed so we were basically flat in the ground because we couldn't hold up any weight at all. But conversely, if we had evolved on a planet that, say, had half G, maybe we'd be tall and thin and Avatar-like, you know, creatures, and not the way we are today. So gravity is something we don't tend to think about, but that really is one of the things that shapes life. A normal condition for life, what we see, is all lovely, and it's just sort of these medium temperatures and so on, but it only describes a very tiny slice of where life can actually survive. We need to have liquid water, but there are organisms that can beat the odds.
All life on Earth shares a unifying factor.
If you look at life on Earth, we're all built on a form of carbon chemistry called organic chemistry, and this seems to be the language of life. If you look out into the interstellar medium, the same compounds are there as on Earth.
Meteorites carrying the building blocks of organic life sometimes fall to Earth. One such meteorite is stored at the California Academy of Sciences.
And the reason this is so exciting to scientists is that it's as old as the solar system, and yet we found that it contains the building blocks of life, things like amino acids and other sorts of chemicals that we use to make our own bodies and all life on Earth. So what it shows is that these building blocks were around in our solar system before life arose on the Earth.
Clark's fascination with the concept of alien life shapes his theory about the evolution of humanity.
I think it's entirely logical that there are extraterrestrials. It's an arrogance to believe that we're the only living organism in this galaxy. I think there's thousands of us, millions of us, and who knows what it is. We're not here by accident. For us to be sitting here right now is so illogical, mathematically, can be proved to be impossible. So you have to ask, along the way, who pushed and pulled and adjusted to make us be what we are now here today.
In Childhood's End, it's the overlords who are pulling the strings. Their mission on Earth? Protect humanity from its own destructive impulses so that we may advance to the next evolutionary plateau. In the novel's conclusion, the children of Earth ascend from their bodies to join a vast cosmic overmind. To truly progress, mankind abandons the Earth.
Clark was really good at dealing with the really big questions. Who are we? Why are we here? What's our place in the universe? And he didn't necessarily always answer those questions, but he explored them in a way that was not based in religion so much as it was based in science and philosophy.
Clark's unique brand of metaphysical sci-fi will make him the most famous futurist in the world and inspire countless scientists. Some of Clark's prophecies are so advanced and far-reaching that we are only now taking steps towards achieving them. But one of Clark's earliest prophecies has already been realized. An invention of such profound magnitude that our modern world would collapse without it. World War II. As German V-2 rockets rain down on London, 27-year-old Arthur C. Clarke is stationed 250 miles away in Cornwall. He mans the Royal Air Force's top-secret radar system, the Mark I. This precise equipment allows operators on the ground to talk down pilots landing in the dark. Clark realizes this new technology can do more than land planes. It can connect the human race. But only with the help of a vast, untapped resource.
I can recall, with some embarrassment, using the dear old Mark I to fire single pulses at the rising moon, waiting for the echo 3 seconds later.
Clark hopes the moon will serve as a natural reflector, bouncing radio signals back to any spot on Earth. He is disappointed. The moon is too far away. But Clark's impromptu experiment leads to a revelation. What if a man-made satellite was launched into space? Orbiting the Earth much closer than the moon, it could reflect the radio waves.
So communications and astronautics were inextricably entangled in my mind, with results that now seem inevitable.
Arthur C. Clarke's concept evolves into the most significant tool of modern communication.
In 1945, Arthur C. Clarke invented the communication satellite. In an issue of Wireless World, Arthur Clarke came up with the idea of what he called the geosynchronous orbit, an orbit in which satellites that were lifted to that height would turn with the Earth and always stay above the same spot of the Earth. So you could bounce signals off it and use it for communications. And Clarke reasoned that if you could put three of them up
equally spaced, you could send signals between them that would reach any place in the world.
In 1965, Intelsat 1 is launched to a height of 22,000 miles above the equator, an orbit now known as the Clark Belt.
Everything about geosynchronous communication satellites today goes back to Clark, and the orbit is named after him. Every time we watch a satellite broadcast on TV, or send a cell phone call, or even read a newspaper, we're interacting with the communication satellite.
By envisioning the satellite, Clark creates the future he wants to live in, a world where the entire human population, from the largest cities to the smallest islands, are connected.
This is one of the ground stations which form the Intelsat network, providing now global communications, telephone, TV, everything you want. And here is a model of this satellite. It's a strange-looking beast. This is a very big thing. It's about 50 feet across. These pick up the signal from the station behind me and then amplify it and then beam it back.
The technology Clark envisioned in 1945 has become the foundation of our attempts to understand humanity's place in the universe. Space telescopes are satellites that beam images of deep space back to Earth. NASA's newest and most ambitious space telescope is the Kepler. Taking flight on March 6, 2009, the Kepler Space Telescope is the first ever satellite solely devoted to the hunt for planets outside our solar system.
The Kepler mission is a telescope orbiting in space, and it's out there to find out if Earths are common or rare. And so it really is mankind's first step in the exploration of the galaxy to find habitable planets.
William Borucki has long been inspired by visionary predictions of humanity's future.
I remember walking to the public library and getting all the books on science fiction. Any of the exploration things where people are exploring new situations, new beings, and the books by Arthur C. Clarke where he talked about the evolution of man and the different kinds of technology that could be employed.
The Kepler team designed their telescope to peer deep into the cosmos, to find corners of space unknown to man.
At the top, it has a lens. It's called a corrector. Below, it has a big mirror, about 5 feet in diameter. The light comes in, hits the mirror, comes back up, and its antennas take the data that we've got and send that to the deep space network.
The Kepler satellite is elegant in its simplicity. It detects planets by measuring how much light is blocked when a planet passes in front of its sun. This is called a transit. On Earth, we can view such a transit whenever our moon passes in front of the sun. In deep space, finding an Earth-like planet transiting a distant star is a greater challenge.
The information behind me are the light curves that we get from the stars, how their brightness changes with time. These each represent several pixels for a particular star. Among these curves, we should be able to find tiny transits that would represent a planet among the stars. So when it goes across the star, the change of the star, it's 1% what change in light would occur. If you just slide a piece of transparent glass in front of some light bulb, it's extremely small. So it's by far the most precise system to measure star brightness ever built.
To date, Kepler has cataloged over 1,200 planet candidates. 54 of those planets are located within habitable zones and, in theory, could support human life. But the nearest is many light years away, and humanity has no way to get there. Yet.
You can liken our quest to understand the life in the universe to what you saw in the Middle Ages. They wanted to build these giant cathedrals. They knew that when they built the foundation, that it would be their children that would erect the walls, their grandchildren that would cover the church, their great-grandchildren that would enjoy the interior and enjoy this wonderful structure. Generation after generation, the quest, the goal will be continued. And that's what we're doing today.
Arthur C. Clarke sees a place for man amongst the stars and dreams of visiting them himself. To push humanity forward, he draws the blueprint for a new space age. An age where all it takes for anyone to explore the universe is a round-trip ticket. ...1953. Science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke has found his own way to experience the cosmos here on Earth.
He loved scuba diving. To Arthur Clarke, scuba diving was as close as he would ever come to being weightless and floating in space.
Clarke is on a diving trip in Florida when he meets 22-year-old Marilyn Mayfield. Within 3 weeks, they are married. But Clarke spends their honeymoon editing his next novel. And the first cracks begin to appear.
They really never knew one another. It was too quick of a courtship. They had some problems. Apparently she wanted more of his time, and writers don't have a lot of time. They're so involved in their stuff.
Clarke and Marilyn separate after a few months. The next time Clarke falls in love, it's not with a person, but a place. The balmy equatorial island of Ceylon, modern-day Sri Lanka.
It was warm and beautiful, and he was sick of how cold and clammy it was in England.
Clarke leaves his homeland to settle permanently in Sri Lanka. Isolated from the modern technological world he helped inspire, Clarke spends his time writing, or underwater.
He started a scuba company called Underwater Safaris. And that was one of his great pleasures in life, was scuba diving in the beautiful tropical waters of Sri Lanka.
Floating, weightless, Clarke dreams of space travel. In 1964, he begins to plot his most ambitious journey to the stars, a collaboration with film director Stanley Kubrick. 2001, A Space Odyssey.
They did a lot of brainstorming, hours upon hours upon hours, at various places around Manhattan. Arthur did almost all the writing. Stanley would say, no, I don't like that. Why don't you try this? Why don't you try this? So he was very active in it. And the two names are on the screenplay.
The film reinvents science fiction and filmmaking forever.
I wasn't really an avid science fiction enthusiast until I saw Stanley's 2001. I was absolutely knocked out and thought that at some point in my life I would do science fiction.
In the film's opening sequence, a mysterious alien monolith triggers the evolution of man. The inspiration to use tools sets off millennia of technological progress.
That classical scene of the ape with the bone going up in the air, I play that to myself over and over again as a representation of the epiphanies of the mind.
2001 is the gold standard of science fiction filmmaking. And I felt like being let in on a possible secret of how humanity came about. You know, it's not every day that you open a book and you maybe get an answer to how did it all happen. You know, it's almost a religious experience disguised in a story.
2001 is very mystical. I think it echoes on the questions that always echo with all of us. Who made us? And where are we going to go afterwards?
In 2001, A Space Odyssey, workers on the moon uncover a giant black monolith beaming a mysterious signal towards Jupiter. They believe it has been buried by aliens millennia earlier. World governments convene a secret council at a moon outpost to decide humanity's next step.
The council members travel to the moon on a Pan Am space plane. Pan Am went out of business in 1991. But in October 2011, Spaceport America, the world's first purpose-built commercial spaceport, opened for business.
Spaceport America is part of Arthur C. Clarke's prophecy of what was to come in his writings in 2001. We're at the Space Operations Center, kind of the hub, the heart of the operations of Spaceport America.
Here in the New Mexico desert, private space companies like Virgin Galactic intend to launch commercial space planes into suborbit.
This is where we're going to park the Virgin motherships. The passengers get to kind of be among the spaceships and the motherships. Looks like something out of a science fiction movie. If you were to buy a ticket, there'll be six passengers and two pilots. There's going to be a training program, getting people mentally prepared for it, probably run about 3 days. You're going to come down this taxiway, out to this 10,000-foot runway, take off in the wind with the mothership carrying the spaceship in the center, and then they're going to drop you.
The Virgin spaceship blasts off at 50,000 feet, bypassing the lower, denser regions of the atmosphere. This allows for a lighter fuselage than ground-launching spaceships. The rocket soars to 350,000 feet, where it floats in suborbit.
When you're up there, you will experience weightlessness. You'll be able to see the curvature of the Earth. And then you'll strap yourself back in and you come back down.
The ship's feather system serves as a fail-safe when the craft re-enters Earth's atmosphere. This design creates a high amount of drag to control speed and altitude, allowing for hands-free re-entry.
This unique feather wing re-entry system is like a badminton birdie. It has a lot of drag to it. When it comes back, it tilts up and slows the spacecraft down and makes a safe, easy landing back on the runway. And it all happens right here over this airspace of the spaceport.
We're living in a very exciting time in the very beginning of commercial space travel. In the very near future, almost anyone can go into space, and how exciting is that?
Clarke envisions that once man conquers space travel, humanity can populate the cosmos. He predicts that human technology will evolve beyond even rocketry. A future where reaching the stars can be as simple as stepping into an elevator. In 1969, Arthur C. Clarke hikes Adam's Peak, a Sri Lankan mountain sacred to Buddhists, Muslims, and Christians alike. A four-mile flight of twisting steps beckons hikers on a spiritual journey to the summit. Atop this sacred peak, Clarke has an epiphany. He imagines a method for humanity to ascend and colonize the universe. A cable stretching into the infinite beyond. Clarke's vision takes shape in a novel that nets him one of the highest honors in science fiction, the Hugo Award.
Arthur C. Clarke in Fountains of Paradise talked about a cable that would take you into heaven, like Jack and the Beanstalk. Well, believe it or not, it is physically possible to build an elevator into outer space.
What you do is you put a big space station in a Clarke orbit, a geosynchronous orbit. The thing is orbiting at the same speed that the Earth rotates, so that it's always above the same spot on Earth.
The top floor of the elevator will be the satellite, 22,000 miles up. Centrifugal force allows the satellite to support the cable connecting it to the ground. Clarke theorizes that space elevators will be essential if humanity is to migrate to the stars.
From now on, there'll always be somebody in space, and more men will occupy space. the space elevator, a single one perhaps first, and then eventually the Earth would be the hub of a wheel with spokes going out, the elevators, and probably more people living outside the Earth than on it.
Clark believed that the rocket was to space travel as the balloon was to aviation. He thought rockets were a completely outdated and outmoded means of transportation almost from the time they were invented.
To take a pound of anything around us and put it into near-Earth orbit costs about $10,000. However, with a space elevator, we may be able to drop that cost perhaps down by a factor of 100.
A space elevator can launch spacecraft from beyond the pull of Earth's gravity and deeper into the cosmos. Easier access to the heavens means lifting mankind closer to Clark's dream of interstellar colonization.
People want to explore the far, far, far frontier beyond our solar system. I think cheap access to space will allow all of that to happen.
As a NASA researcher in the early 2000s, Michael Lane studied the feasibility of space elevators. Lane was so intrigued by the concept that he has spent the past decade independently designing and testing equipment that could someday power a real space elevator.
I'm committed to building an elevator to space because once I saw it, that was it.
To construct a space elevator, engineers must first solve two technical challenges. The first, how to power the elevator cab during its long ascent without heavy cables or onboard fuel.
We would beam power from a large laser array on the ground to solar receivers on the lifter climbing into space.
Second, the cable must be very light, yet strong enough that it doesn't snap. In The Fountains of Paradise, Clark solves this problem with an imaginary carbon-based filament made of diamonds.
Clark predicted a supermaterial, what we now call carbon nanotubes. What makes them important is both their structure and their strength. Nanotubes grown in the lab look very promising, but then we have to mass produce them at a level that can support a 100,000-kilometer elevator to space.
For now, Lane tests his theories with models.
So this is our bot. It's a mock-up of what an eventual space elevator could become. You've got a tread system, so the tread will actually grip the ribbon between the tread, and as the rollers spin, you'll climb.
At this scale, Lane's elevator cab has room for only one passenger.
This is our mascot, and his name is Clark. We named him Clark from the very first time in honor of Arthur C. Clarke.
Lane and his team are about to put their tiny prototype to the test.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's a long way from this climbing bot to an actual space elevator. But Lane aims to build on the foundation laid by Arthur C. Clarke. And he's not alone.
There's more than 60 universities in the United States working on this project. There's a very large, active community getting this thing built.
Lane and others are taking up Clark's torch to achieve a goal that Fountains of Paradise portrays as essential to the growth of humanity. Clark predicts that mankind won't be alone on our journey to deep space. We'll rely on artificial intelligence to guide our travels. But what happens if our computerized companion has an agenda of its own? ...1973. Arthur C. Clarke, recognized for decades as a prophet of science fiction and science, unveils the secrets to his prophetic success. The three laws of prediction.
The first law is when a distinguished, venerable scientist states that something is possible, it probably is possible. But when a distinguished scientist says something is impossible, it's still probably possible.
Arthur C. Clarke's second law says that in order to make great discoveries, you have to go beyond the possible into the realm of the impossible. All the great scientists of the past centuries went into the realm of the impossible in order to make fantastic discoveries.
But it is Clarke's third law that profoundly captures his vision of the future.
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. We've seen that in human history. One culture has an advanced technology, the other can't really explain it.
Think of our ancestors, our grandparents in the year 1900. If they could see us today with our rockets and our GPS and our satellites, they would consider us to be wizards and sorcerers. So look around. Everywhere you look, you see Arthur C. Clarke's third law in action.
Clarke himself acknowledges the pitfalls of prophecy.
The prophet invariably falls between two stools. If his predictions sound at all reasonable, you can be quite sure that in 20 or at most 50 years, the progress of science and technology has made him seem ridiculously conservative. On the other hand, if by some miracle a prophet could describe the future exactly as it was going to take place, his predictions would sound so absurd, so far-fetched, that everybody would laugh him to scorn.
2001: A Space Odyssey is published at a time when computers are less powerful than a modern calculator. Clarke evolves this primitive technology into a supercomputer. A system so advanced, it seems to have a mind of its own. HAL 9000.
I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. I'm sure you'll agree there's some truth in what I say.
HAL, I think, was a genius. That idea that a computer will be more intelligent than us. You know, what the scariest thing is going to be is when we design the definitive computer. The first job that will do will be to design another computer. All that is marvelous. But I think there's probably a negative side to that as well. It's always a dichotomy. Wherever you get one evolution, there's going to be a counter reaction, adverse reaction. It hasn't got to that yet, but when that happens, that's going to be very interesting.
HAL 9000 displays traditionally human faculties: independent reasoning, language processing, critical thinking, and neuroses.
He's basically a computer that becomes so human that he's able to go insane, like a human being can go insane. That can be a terrifying concept, particularly if that computer is in charge of your life support systems.
HAL 9000 has inspired and terrified two generations of computer scientists.
I've still got the greatest enthusiasm and confidence in the mission.
David Ferrucci is the man behind IBM's latest and most famous breakthrough in artificial intelligence, the supercomputer Watson.
Well, I think of Watson as sort of this information-seeking tool, something that you could dialogue with naturally, that has a somewhat of a neutral personality, if you will. Not so much HAL, right? The HAL's not the direction I would go with Watson's personality.
In February of 2011, Watson squares off on Jeopardy against the quiz show's two biggest returning champions.
Watson is fast, knows a lot of stuff, and can really dominate a match.
Watson handily defeats both men.
Watson.
What is clock?
Clock is correct. And with that, you move up to 23,440.
I was just amazed by that. And I thought, this is the future. I can program a computer to do anything I can imagine.
Sophisticated algorithms allow Watson to learn how seemingly random words may be connected.
It can't connect the words to human experiences, but what it does do is it connects the words and the phrases and the sentences that it reads to other words and phrases that might mean the same thing.
But Ferrucci believes it will be many years before Watson even begins to approach the abilities of HAL in 2001.
Is it really intelligent? Is it intelligent the way humans are intelligent? That's still an open question.
Clark predicts a disastrous downside to advanced computers. But in 1984, Clark falls ill, and the PC proves to be his best friend. Through computers and the satellites he imagined, Clark's intellect is free to travel the world and collaborate with a new generation of brilliant science minds. It's 1986, and 69-year-old Arthur C. Clarke is often confined to a wheelchair in his Sri Lankan home. Despite his far-flung locale, fans still track him down.
Arthur C. Clarke was generous. He was open to all comers and very much a people person.
Among the travelers is the chief engineer of NASA's Galileo mission to Jupiter, Gentry Lee.
He wanted to know all about Galileo, what we were going to do, and he asked me if I would had any interest whatsoever in collaborating.
Rendezvous with Rama is Clark's Hugo Award-winning 1972 masterpiece.
Suddenly, a giant spaceship the size of a metropolitan area arrives in our solar system. And as of that moment, human beings know that there is something out there that is as far advanced compared to us as we are compared to ants or plants.
An advanced meteor warning system called Space Guard detects the alien ship.
Space Guard was Arthur's idea that it would set up human beings to monitor the set of stuff that was all flying around and had a chance to hit the Earth.
In 1992, NASA establishes its own near-Earth objects discovery program. They name it Space Guard after the asteroid warning system Clark prophesies in Rendezvous with Rama. Clark and Gentry Lee co-write three Rama sequels.
Arthur never once, in dealing with me, made himself out to be the Delphic Oracle. He was warm and hospitable in every intellectual level.
Clark retains his passion for discovery and wonder until the very end.
As the things that he predicted started to happen, what I noticed in him was sadness when things didn't happen. And so Arthur was making a list, even in his 90s, of the things that he predicted would happen that could have happened, they just haven't gotten there yet, and would people hurry up and get them done?
In 2008, Arthur C. Clarke dies at age 90. He leaves behind a legacy of fulfilled prophecy and a wealth of inspiration for the future.
Clarke is such a broad inspiration. You can't be writing about people traveling through space without thinking of 2001, where you're literally discovering, you know, the influence of an alien race. That, in a way, is the Big Bang of modern sci-fi cinema.
Clarke's enthusiasm for science and discovery, optimism for the unknown, and love for humanity remain as a blueprint for the great minds that will lead us into the future.
Fundamentalists don't ask about God because they know the answer. Atheists don't ask because they think it is unanswerable. But Arthur Clarke was a man of science who wasn't afraid to explore the spiritual needs of mankind.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that presentation about Arthur C. Clarke and a little bit more about the Liftport Group. Obviously, it's a privately held Washington State corporation founded in 2003 by Michael Lane. You can find out more on their website, obviously, in detail at www.liftport.com. The company is focused on the construction of a space elevator that he talked about in the presentation using carbon nanotubes. And carbon nanotubes are obviously allotropes of carbon with a cylindrical nanostructure. These cylindrical carbon molecules have unusual properties which are valuable for nanotechnology, electronics, optics, and other fields of materials used in science and technology. In particular, owing to their extraordinary thermal conductivity and mechanical and electrical properties, carbon nanotubes find applications as additives to various structural materials. For instance, nanotubes form a tiny portion of the material or materials in some primarily carbon fiber used in, say, baseball bats, golf clubs, or car parts. Nanotubes are a member of the fullerene structural family, which we've talked about on the show before in depth. Their name is derived from their long, hollow structure with the walls formed by one-atom-thick sheets of carbon called graphene. So if you remember back about a year ago, we did a really good episode on graphene and its applications and uses, and actually the discovery of graphene. More about the Liftport Group. They did have plans in 2005 for a carbon nanotube manufacturing plant. And it was set to open in 2005. Apparently, they've got even more projects on the burners that they would rather focus on at this time. In 2011, on the Liftport website, Lane announced that Liftport is pursuing a lunar space elevator as an interim goal before attempting a terrestrial elevator. At the 2011 annual meeting of the Lunar Exploration Analysis Group, or League, L-E-A-G, Liftport CTO Marshall Eubanks presented a paper on the lunar elevator co-authored by Michael Lane. You can look that up. And in August 2012, Liftport announced the launch of their Kickstarter funding for their lunar space elevator. And that Kickstarter fund, you can still find it, it's still online. I looked it up at Space Elevator Kickstarter. This project successfully exceeded its funding goal on September 13, 2012, requesting $8,000, but they raised $110,000 from 3,468 backers. So, not too shabby, public. It seems everybody really wants to get behind these privately and publicly funded programs for lifting ourselves off of this planet. I don't know what it is about the wanderlust of humans, but basically it's just not enough to sit here and, you know, enjoy this blue planet. We want to get up, get out, and find another one. And if you look at the way the environment's going, maybe that's not such a bad idea, right? Anyway, that's more about that Liftport. And again, you can find out more specifics about what they've done, what they're going to do at www.liftport.com. Well, that about wraps up another episode of Savage Science Radio. I'd like to thank Nick Peluco for the beautiful show graphics, Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that awesome intro that we use every week, and none other than Todd Sheets, our executive producer and owner of the Jackalope Network. We're going to leave you with another space parody of Keisha's We Are Who We Are, and it's by Jank, and you can find more by Jank at www.jankjank.com. Until next week, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
Astrobiology. If you're new to this, then get ready. While you're living here all snug on Earth, there may be life in the universe. And this might sound insane, just give me a minute to explain. I'm not talking about Martian men in suits, I'm just talking about prokaryotes. Oats, oats. Is there life beyond the Earth? Thriving in the universe. We are cranking up the search. So let's go, oh, oh. Let's go! We're searching for E. T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T-T use spectroscopy to make discoveries. Astrobiology. Saturn's moon Titan. Inside microbes, but it makes us sick. Our DNA's backed by phosphorus. It just makes science more mysterious. Liquid H2O. Find it out in space and the chances grow. Well, we could find life. Searching the stars. Probably won't find little green dudes on Mars. We found life right here on Earth. That could change the way we search. What would these answers be worth? Only one way to know. Let's go! Europa's really neat. Could have water underneath. A massive crack that sheet. We'll have to go and see. Astrobiology. Enceladus is cold. With something neat to note. Ice spewing volcanoes. More questions I foresee. Chances are looking up. Searching for E.T., but it's really hard to see. We could use spectroscopy to make discoveries. Astrobiology, that's real hard to define. Fine, cause of evidence we find. It's changing all the time. Cause of new discoveries.
It's been 26 really long years. No days of torture, but he was bitter. Galileo was forced to stay home because he made better telescopes with more power. La la la. The Inquisition. La. Not geocentric. La la la. Oh well. La la la. Look at the sky tonight. At observatories on the top of the world tonight. Satellites are dancing at the edge of the atmosphere. Telescopes could be reflecting radio or refracting, making light more bright up the sky tonight. He saw that Jupiter had many moons. Was able to see Saturn, Milky Way had many stars. Surface of the moon was not so smooth. Thanks, Galileo Galilei. La la la. Whatever. La la la. Heliocentric. La la la. Oh well. La la la. Look at the sky tonight. At observatories on the top of the world tonight. Satellites are dancing at the edge of the atmosphere. Telescopes could be reflecting radio. Making life more bright up the sky tonight. You gotta sing it like, whoa, come on, it's all a matter. Whoa, everybody now. Telescopes reflecting, use mirrors, keep the light up and shoot it on down. But refracting, use convex lenses, focus the light to the eyepiece lens. Radio detects no vibrations, focus the rays from far outer space. Tonight!
dance, nobody.